Welcome to the Speakeasy with Kate Wand, a safe space to discuss liberal ideas.
I had an extremely evocative discussion with Dr. Julie Panessi, who is a PhD in ethics and ancient philosophy. Dr. Panessi works for the Democracy Fund, where she questions the narrative and challenges the ethical principles that are being employed in our modern world. It was a pleasure to speak with Julie. We got into different topics, mainly the ideological divide between collectivism and individualism, utilitarianism and how that's applied, as well as the concept of the greater good and where we see society as having landed and ways to move forward. So I hope you enjoy this discussion.
I think before having a child, when you think about the responsibilities of parenthood, you think about things like when you're pregnant, being healthy for her, and then when she's born, you know, taking care of her physical health and making sure the house is safe and thinking about schooling. You know, you think about those things, but you don't really realize that you also need to do what you can as a citizen to create a world in which it's possible for her to have a life. And that really... the events of the last year and a half or so have punctuated that responsibility, so that when you're a parent, you are also a citizen. And when there's a crisis in your state, you know, you need to, part of your job as a parent is to try to address that, try to fix that, because there's no point in doing all this work, to feed your child correctly and to help to give them a good character and to do all of it and to educate them in certain ways. There's no point to all of that if they don't have a world in which they can be safe and free and build a life for themselves. And yes. I don't think we have that world right now, right? Or at least it's falling apart. It's a house of cards that's kind of falling apart one card at a time, you know, and we're going to reach a threshold, and I fear very soon, where we're going to take out that critical card and it's all just going to collapse, you know. So we have to, I think, do what we can while we can. And in some sense, I feel like there's no justification, there's no luxury to rest.
No. So it's like, you know, you were just saying those late nights where you're used to, you kind of, motherhood flips that switch where you did not realize that you were capable of functioning under so little sleep. And it doesn't stay that way forever. I mean, just the first few weeks, you just think, will it always be like this?
Yes.
And then, you know, by the time you've actually gotten used to it, a few months later, something switches again, and then your baby starts sleeping longer periods. You're like, oh my gosh,
what did I just do there? It's quite.
But yeah. You start, you know, being able to tap into that physical strength even and mental strength that you didn't know that you possessed. And maybe it's part of the gift. Maybe it's part of the trade-off of becoming a parent where you actually possess these new skills that you can flex a little bit.
I don't know where the limit of that is, but I think it can be extended quite far, because when you care so much about the vitality of this little creature who you know, relies on you and the people around her for everything, you won't stop at anything to protect her or him, your child, you know? And so it's possible to, I can't tell you the number of sleepless nights, not just because she was awake, but because I'm working on something, because I have a project due the next day, or I'm trying to get a speech together, and I have, you know, and whatever it is. I think these days I don't want to be in the position 2 years down the road or a decade down the road and look back and think, if only I had done something more, if only I had done something differently, maybe things wouldn't have turned out so badly. And that's a heavy load to bear, but yes. I think that's the reality of our situation, and part of, moral agency is realizing when a lot is demanded of you and figuring out how to meet that expectation or how to meet that need.
Yeah. It's really interesting because I was, you know, in preparing for this talk, I was thinking, well, we're going to be talking about ethics and we're going to be talking about philosophy. And so I gave myself a little bit of a crash course last night. And one of the things that came up with was aggregation, which is like the sum of the best things for everybody and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And what I'm thinking about right now, we can maybe get into it a little bit later. But my thought is that not everybody is doing things equally. You know, like what you're doing is part of the reason for that is because so many citizens have kind of have not been following any sense of civic duty. Mm. They've been kind of waiting for a rescuer to come into the situation, you know, for the government to say, well, don't worry, guys, now you've done everything that you need to do. So it's okay. We're going to, you know, we're going to flip the switch again and you'll just be free again and everything will be fine and everything will go back to the way it was. And there's an imbalance there as well. And this, I think, is directly correlated to the way that things are playing out in a really utilitarian sense. So you also have that splash into the personal realm where many people are spending sleepless nights because they're just doing all of this kind of work.
Compensating work.
Yes.
In some sense, it feels like.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think a couple of interesting things come up for me hearing you say that. And one is, you know, what our responsibilities as citizens in a democracy really are. Mm. And I think about this a lot, and my feeling, and I would be interested to hear from people who think I've misunderstood this, but my feeling is that over the last many decades, I think, the ones that I've been alive for, it's harder to speak to the previous times, but my feeling is that most people's sense of democracy is very outcome-oriented, result-oriented, in the sense that we feel our job as democratic citizens in a country like Canada or maybe in the US and some European countries is to vote. And we show up on voting day and then I'm good. I did my job as a democratic citizen, right? But forgetting that process is also important, and maybe it's equally important. And by that, I mean something like understanding what lies in the background of the decisions that we make on voting day or referendum day or something like that, right? And so things like town hall meetings and citizens assemblies and just in a less formal way, but creating dialogue in society where citizens learn how to explore the ideas and the reasoning of other citizens. We have to be better, I think, at learning about who our fellow citizens are, why they believe what they do, why, you know, what is it that matters to us equally? Aristotle's very well, he came from a little town called Stagira, and he's very well known for saying that he thought it was the perfectly sized town because you can go to a high point in the city and look down and see the whole thing. And I think what he seemed to mean by that, when you read what he has to say in his work, The Politics, is that it's important for us to know our fellow citizens. And you can't do that beyond a certain, I mean, you look at the, you know, 3 million, you know, cities that are composed of 3 million people or something like that, even London, which has hundreds of thousands of people in it now. It's really, in principle, impossible to know all of those people. And if you don't know them, you don't understand why they do what they do and what matters to them. And I think we've lost this sense of understanding the reasoning behind the decisions that we make. And that's essential for democracy. And I think one of the reasons it's essential is because it helps us to understand what we agree about and what we don't agree about.
Right.
Right. So when we're talking about all of this, you know, the COVID situation, if someone hears you say, I'm not sure about vaccine passports, immediately there's no more interest in looking at the reasoning behind that. Right?
Yeah.
It's just, well, if that's what you think, then it must be the case that nothing else you think is of value to me. I don't care what your reasons are. And by the way, I'm going to put you out on the sort of social ice floe and I would like never to hear from you again.
Right? And you're talking about people in their personal
realm?
Oh, I think so. Or whether we're talking about people who engage with one another in the comment section in a newspaper on social media or wherever, right? Yeah. I think we're very quick to jump to conclusions based on isolated things that people say or ask or do without looking a little further into why they hold those beliefs. And I think it's very important to try to figure out what we agree about.
Yes.
So we hear talk about safety a lot these days, right? There's this great focus on keeping people safe and protecting people. And my guess is that that's a value that a great many people share, even if we disagree about how you achieve that.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Mm-hmm. So people can disagree about what the data is showing, whether or not lockdowns are effective and what we mean by effectiveness in that context, whether or not the vaccines are perfectly safe and effective and what we mean by safety and effectiveness in that context. We can disagree about those data points and about that evidence and still agree that keeping people safe is important, right? And I think when we understand that we have that shared value, we're more willing to continue a conversation with another person.
Right. You need to find the middle ground where you can actually connect, because otherwise it comes down to kind of like seeing the humanity in the other person rather than just seeing. I've been talking about this recently with somebody named Barry Brownstein, where he talks about the I it versus the I thou. And this is, you know, the philosophy of seeing people as objects versus as people. And if you don't have that kind of common ground, then it's very difficult.
Yeah. Right. It's very interesting. I think that it connects very nicely, very eloquently to this othering that we're seeing, right? We're seeing, I mean, all of this language of, you know, anti-vaxxer, vaccine hesitant, it's all othering language, right? Mm-hmm. It's an attempt to distance oneself from people. We can hardly even use that term, because the ones who try to stigmatize in this way, mm-hmm. I think are trying to dehumanize the holders of those positions,
yes.
right?
Yes.
And so I think we have a long-standing tendency or desire as a human species to other people who hold views that we don't disagree with, that are different from ours, or that we find threatening in some way. And we want to isolate them to make clear that we aren't part of that group.
Right.
Right. And why do we do that? I think it's intimately connected to our need to belong. And we don't want to be cast off from the group. So mm-hmm. if we can other someone else, that solidifies our social ties to the group that matters to us, right?
And I'd like to bring up that on, if you want to say the other side of the argument, you also see that tribal thinking, because people are referring to people who subscribe to the mainstream narrative as a herd, or as cattle, or as non-humans as well. Like there's a way of looking at people that maybe, you know, you would like to reach, but still looking at them as it's, well, you'll never reach them. And, you know, I found myself in a situation like that one day. I was sitting, you know, when they implemented the vaccine passports, it was devastating for so many people. And mm-hmm. I happened to be out, you know, we were at the dentist. So I said, well, I need to go eat somewhere. And it was still warm enough that I could eat on a patio, so I didn't have to partake in any of that system.
Yeah.
And so I was on the patio and somebody came in, and I felt like they were kind of socially posturing, right? Like they had put on their mask mm-hmm. outside. They had came in and you know, done the whole thing, which I feel is like
visibly.
public health theater. And so right away I rolled my eyes and I was like, oh my gosh, here we go. And I realized, just because I was familiar with this philosophy, I had just read something about it. I was like, you are doing the exact same thing. So you are dehumanizing this person.
Yeah.
So then I said, okay, let's do a little experiment and try and actually see if you can connect with this person.
Mm-hmm.
And I did, you know, and we ended up actually having a conversation. We talked about motherhood. We talked about families. We talked about careers. And we actually ended up connecting and becoming acquainted. And by the end, we exchanged information. And I was like, well, if you add me on Facebook, you'll see it's very political.
That's really interesting. And I can feel as you're talking how much mental energy and work that required, probably. Right. Probably on both sides, but probably your side more so because the other person may
wasn't aware,
realize.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah.
And so you can understand why people shy away from that's doing right. that just because of the enormous risk involved and the enormous mental energy. But that's what's required. And I think it's so interesting that you had that higher level awareness that your response to this person that you knew was on the other side of so many issues that are so important yeah. right now, you were able to be aware of that and check yourself and think reflectively about the behavior you wanted to produce, and you were able to modify. But those are all skills of a highly aware moral agent, I think.
I feel flattered.
Right? But, I mean, you get an A+, but do you know what yeah. I mean? I mean, yeah. I think that kind of... And often I think we are very able to act very well as a moral agent just by thinking reflectively about what we're doing.
Yes.
Right. I think moral agency doesn't require perfection. It requires diligence, right? And I think diligence in the moral sphere has to do with questioning our own behavior and yes. questioning our motives and thinking about whether we could do something better, and empathy is an yeah. enormous component to that, I think. And what you are describing in that situation required a lot of empathy. We tend to think of empathy as being very emotive, but I think empathy requires a great act of imagination, act of the imagination, not an act of imagination, right? Yes. Because it requires you to try to imagine what it's like to be another person, yes. which is very hard to do, right? And it takes a lot of mental work. And I think there's a vulnerability to it because we there might be some fear,
yeah,
you know, associated with, well, if I do put myself in the shoes of another person, what might I be likely to find out? Is it something
and find out
will,
about myself?
And find out about myself and find out about my own biases and maybe yes. errors that I've made in my yes. thinking and some assumptions that were not only poorly founded, but may have caused harm. And so, you know, I think when you engage in that act of empathy and trying to connect with someone that you know is on the other side of many issues, yes. there's a lot of, you're putting yourself under a microscope that might not reveal good things about yourself. Right. But thank goodness we have that opportunity, because only then do we have the chance to potentially revise what we've done and who we are and move forward differently in the future.
And it's strange because what we have now is, like it or not, there's an ideological line. There is a divide, mm-hmm. right? And so one thing that I tend to think is that people who are maybe on the side that I'm on, and I would like to say that I fall into some kind of spectrum, or at least I hope. I don't want to be too dogmatic about things. Mm-hmm. But I do see that on the other side of that ideological line, which is more of a collectivist line, mm-hmm. I feel like I'm part of the individualist camp. Mm-hmm. On that side, it seems that part of the reason that there's so many problems is exactly the opposite of what I'm describing, where the people who fall into the collectivist camp are people who are not necessarily willing or able to do that kind of reflection.
Well, you know, as you're talking, it makes me, I've wondered about why is this? And I think you're right that, you know, if someone said to me, well, why is my view or our view better than the prevailing narrative or the view of the collectivists? And if for no other reason, I think one reason it's better is because it's inclusive. Because I think you are willing to talk to other people mm-hmm. who are willing, you know, willing to have a conversation with someone who doesn't necessarily agree with us. And I think that a lot of the sort of narrative holders are not willing to do that. And I've wondered, well, why is this? Why do we see? And I think that, you know, I don't mean to paint that. That's a pretty big brush that I'm painting that scenario yeah. with. You know, there are surely exceptions on both sides yes. of this ideological sort of divide. But and I wonder, well, why is this? If this is an semi-accurate characterization of what's going on, why would that be? And one hypothesis I'm just having now, listening to you speak, is that if you are a collectivist, why would you be motivated to listen to someone other person? Because that makes that reveals the fact that you value this individual. You value the opinions of this individual.
Right.
And if you're a collectivist, why would you do that? You already have a commitment to the values of the group. And the values of the group are not the values of individual opinions and individual contributions. So I think our fundamental ideological divide is, as you say, it's a collectivist versus an individualist approach. And on that topic, we have this tendency to think that individualism is a synonym for selfishness or something like that, right? And I think it's really important to, like, let's talk about that now, because I think it's important to address that. And I can offer what my opinion on that is, but I would invite people who are watching to think a little bit about this and to chat with their friends and family about it. But, you know, to be an individual, is that to be selfish? Does that mean you're focused on the self? Not necessarily, right? It might just mean that you think that your sole responsibility as a moral agent is not to sacrifice yourself for the group. And there are a number of views that could come out of that. You know, you might think, you might still be a martyr in some respect, because you might think that it's your obligation to sacrifice yourself for some other person.
Yes.
Or you might think that it's, you know, not your obligation to sacrifice at all, but to try to do good things in the world or do good things for other people. But I do wonder if the reason why we're seeing an almost intractable debate between pro and anti-narrative defenders is that we're speaking a different moral language.
Yes.
Right? We're, you know, I think that you and I would say everyone's views matter.
Mm-hmm.
And the collectivists would say not everyone's views matter.
Right.
So how can we have a conversation?
The language itself doesn't accurately describe the practical. I think that's the problem. And that's actually, as I was saying, I was doing a little bit of research before you came here. Mm. And the language around utilitarianism, for example, sounds very good.
Great. It sounds fantastic. Like you'd want to put that on a t-shirt.
Right.
Why not?
Which is basically like the sum of all of the best things for all of the best people.
That's what it sounds like. It sounds like we talk in moral philosophy about happiness pumps. So it sounds like the utilitarianism is in favor of pumping or producing
most
as much happiness into the world.
Right.
And it's just this world full of rainbows and balloons all
that's
the time.
That's it. Exactly. So it sounds very, very good.
That's a bit derogatory, I should say. But, you know, I mean, I think that's kind of the impression that we have.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no. And I think that this is why many people subscribe to that collectivist ideology, because the language sounds very good.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that also separates higher thinking is being able to determine if people's actions match their words, right? So if you have this kind of collectivist language that says you are doing things for the greater good, you are sacrificing yourself for others, you care about others. These individualists don't. They're individualists. So they're selfish and they are self-interested. And, you know, all of those things sound quite bad to somebody who doesn't actually go and see what do they look like in practice. Well, an individualist in practice, because of their self-interest, is very likely to look out for the people around them. My self-interest is to take care of my husband, my son, my friends, my family, all of the people around me.
And maybe even strangers, because, you know, the evidence does not show that collectivists necessarily contribute more to charity, for example. So it's not like
because they expect the state to do it.
Well, in certain kinds of collectivists, that's right.
Right.
That's right. And you made an interesting point about whether or not people's actions match their words or their language. And I would want to introduce a third element there to the moral life. So now we have what people say is important, morally speaking, what their actions are. And then in between those two things, we have how we present ourselves to the world as a moral agent. And I think virtue signaling is part of that, right? So virtue signaling is this, some kind of outward expression that's meant to show someone else what you think or how good your character is, right? So, and those are three related but distinct things. So now that person you described who went into the coffee shop or the restaurant, you know, visibly putting on the mask. And you do see this in stores and public places a lot. I think grand ritualistic ways of putting on hand sanitizer, you know, everybody see what I'm doing here. That's a kind of virtue signaling.
Yes.
And so that does not always match people's actions. And it, although it is a kind of action, right? And it does not always match what we believe about the world, what we think about the world. And I think that our impression of another person's character and who they are as an agent and what their worth is reduced to our perception of their signaling virtue.
Yes.
Right? So we see someone else, you value to me to the extent that you say the right things and do the right things and perform the right actions in society. Yeah. I don't care to know anything more about you. I don't need to know anything more about right. you. If you hand sanitize in the right way, then I'm willing to welcome you into my tribe.
That's it. Exactly. Right? Tribe is the word, because then you've seen now that you're one of us, and therefore, because you're one of us, then everything else is permissible, right? Yeah. And that's where you also kind of find the flaws in the utilitarian logic, because everything is permissible as long as, you know, the sum of everything is greater. And a really simplistic way of looking at this is, well, let's say, you know, 2 + 2 = 4. So in the utilitarian mindset, the sum is the most important thing. So you and I are sitting here and both of our cups are filled to 2. So everything is great, right? But how does that actually work in practice if you have 0 + 4 = 4, 1 + 3 = 4? So what if I only have 1 and you have 3, but we've gotten to 4? So society at large is balanced. Everything is good. It doesn't matter. So this is where you see that if there are any problems with a system, for example, you have the vaccine passports, you know, well, if you lose your job, that's a 0. But for somebody who's a big pharma pusher, that might be a 4.
Or someone who got hired because you lost your job.
Right.
Who wouldn't have had a job otherwise. Right. It's a 4 for that
person. Or then you enter another person. Maybe that's a 2 for him and a 2 for him. It doesn't matter how many individuals make the sum either.
That is, I mean, you're honing in, I think, one of the things that makes utilitarianism unique as a moral theory, and that it doesn't track the process.
Right.
That gets us to a result.
Okay.
Or it doesn't attach moral value. Mm. What matters, so utilitarianism is a form of consequentialism. So what matters, the only thing that matters to the exclusion of all else, is what the world looks like at the end of the day, what the consequences of actions are. It doesn't matter how we got there. And I won't be explicit about this, but in the utilitarian system, the basic utilitarian system, unless you're a modified rule utilitarian in some way, but in the sort of unmodified utilitarian system, you could achieve certain ends by any means possible. And that would be morally justified. Mm-hmm. So if your ultimate goal is to get everybody educated, right? Or to create, we can't even say get everybody educated, but if your ultimate goal is to create a certain kind of workforce, right, that has a certain sort of educational background, mm-hmm. any sacrifices are possible to individuals in order to achieve that. And that's morally justified.
Yes.
Right. And I think we're seeing that now in the popular discourse and in social media, there's a great willingness to sacrifice the outliers,
yes,
for the sake of what people are calling a public good. One of the problems here, though, is that this utilitarian notion is piggybacking on some pretty poor interpretation of science. You know, we've got our fear is running rampant over this Omicron variant. And when you look at the numbers and the millions of people in Ontario, and we've hit 2 hospitalizations or something, and that was just reported this morning, you know. So it's not even clear that those defending this collective good, you know, we must restrict, we must limit, we must excise for the sake of promoting the health of the good or of the group. It's not clear that what we're doing is even achieving that, right, because it's based on some, I think, misguided interpretation of the science. And,
yes,
and you know, it was just in the Globe and Mail yesterday. It's about 67% of the new cases are in fully vaccinated people, you know. So now I think on the other side, our government surely is saying that, well, that's because we haven't achieved herd immunity. And by the way, for herd immunity, we need 100%, which is like, you know, talk about moving goalposts. But it's very odd to me that even for people who know nothing about immunology, nothing about what, you know, what a respiratory virus is, what nothing about what a sterilizing versus non-sterilizing vaccine are, even if we know nothing about that, you would think it would be odd for most people to hear that 10 or 15% of the population could be a threat to, I won't even say fully vaccinated, but doubly vaccinated 85% of the population, and that our case numbers are no better than they were before we started all of this vaccinating. Right. So,
well, this is actually points out another flaw, which I found in my digging on utilitarianism and the ins and outs of that, is that it's solely based on the outcomes. And yet, in every single case that I can think of or that I've seen of utilitarianism applied, you never actually reach the outcome. Mm-hmm. It's impossible to meet the outcome desired. And I think part of the reason for that is because the notion is that it will be to achieve an outcome for the greater good. But the greater good doesn't exist. To me, it's fictional.
It's an empty notion. Yeah. So I don't, do tell me if this is what you're thinking along these lines, but when we're talking about the good for an individual, I think we can understand that because we know what it is to feel pleasure or pain or satisfaction or emptiness ourselves as an individual, you know, what it means for those things to be felt by a group of people is a very, I mean, without even talking about whether or not it's right to think in that way or wrong to think in that way, it's conceptually very difficult to think in that way, right? And an example I often use is if we're talking about physical pain, for example, and you have a headache, it's easy to understand how that affects a person. Right. And it's easy to understand how you take some Tylenol and you alleviate that pain and then there's a benefit to that individual. But if we're talking about physical pain in a group, or mental pain, or the relief of physical or mental pain in a group, how do we understand how that affects a group without explaining it by focusing on how it affects the individual members of that group? So now you tell me if I mischaracterized what you were thinking there, but I think that to me, the idea of a group acting as a unified
a soul organism
is at the very least a tricky conceptual idea. That doesn't mean that it's wrong. You know, I mean, there's a lot of interesting literature within academic ethics about collectivism and collective responsibility. And I think there's something quite important about that because we want to understand how corporations, for example, that cause great harms can and should be held responsible for those harms in some way. Right.
So the corporation would be seen as the collective in a sense?
Well, that's the idea.
It's not just one individual.
That's right.
Okay, gotcha. Right?
And how you can't just absolve responsibility because you say, well, I was acting as Pfizer, for example, not as just
that's where my mind was going.
Well, their results just came out and they're not looking so great for Pfizer. So but I think it's there's this question about whether or not this collectivist idea and thinking of the group as a moral entity itself makes any kind of sense. And, you know, I was actually thinking on my way here about the notion of integrity. You're going to think, what? This is not connected, but let me try to explain my way to this.
Of course.
So integrity, I think we often think of that as a synonym for something like goodness or virtue. But technically speaking, it has to do with like the wholeness of a system, right? So we can talk about the integrity of your car and how well it's functioning or the integrity of a financial plan or something, right? So it has to do with the parts and how they function in relation to a whole. So in the moral context, when a person has integrity, we think that, well, one thing they do is act consistently with their deeply held beliefs and values, right? Otherwise, you wouldn't have the wholeness of the part. You wouldn't have consistency among your beliefs and your actions, right? When it comes to a group, it's much harder to understand how that group can act as a whole and have integrated parts. And what does that mean? Does that mean that everyone in the group has to believe the same things? Well, maybe. I mean, that's certainly what we're seeing now. Mm-hmm. If you're going to be a group, then you can't have disparate scientific, moral, political beliefs, or you start to fracture the group, right? My own view is that human nature is not such as to be capable of or to flourish in that sort of context. And that's why we need at least a minimal concept of individualism, which is more authentically who we are as moral agents. And therefore, because that's who we are, that's what our human nature, the reality of our human nature, that means that our political systems need to be structured around that psychological reality. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it isn't, the fact that our political system is morphing into a kind of collectivism, like an authoritarian collectivism, mm-hmm. something like that, mm-hmm. I think that's why we're seeing so many problems, because we have a fundamental misunderstanding of who we are as human beings, you know?
That is so poignant. I think that you're absolutely right. I don't think you can separate authoritarian and collectivist, because collectivism, in my view, can only happen from the top. It's a hive mind.
Mm.
I don't think that collectivism can be applied to humans because of exactly what you've just described. Mm-hmm. I think that everything needs to come from the top in collectivism, and that's why historically it has, if you look at mm-hmm. other collectivist systems, mm-hmm. because everybody needs to be doing the same thing, which is impossible. It's impossible to meet those ends. It's impossible to have everybody in line. So what happens is you end up having this ideology, which is pushed onto the collective. They have to buy every single part of it. It doesn't have to make sense. It just has to be consistent and conform for everybody.
Yeah.
And so
and there can't be dissension. There can't be questioning. There can't be opposition in political context. Authoritarian states, they don't allow opposing political parties.
Right.
And no opposing political moral views at the individual level, right? To follow your sort of hive analogy to its mm-hmm. logical conclusion, I think most people think that collectivism is just a matter of the worker bees getting along well. But in any hive situation, you have a hierarchy mm-hmm. of order. Mm-hmm. And so the question here is, well, who's the queen bee and how good is that person?
And what happens to the bees that don't fit the system? Well, the other bees attack them. Correct. And then they die.
And that's what we see that in the animal kingdom. And yes. I think we see our government officials encouraging that behavior,
right.
Our educators encouraging that behavior. And we're seeing that mentality taken on by non-government leaders in society. And by that, I mean, you know, it could be teachers, it can be physicians, it can be people in dominant position in their social group. And we're seeing them say to the people that they influence that this is the behavior that's acceptable if you want to stay in the group. Oh, and by the way, it's not a range of behavior. It's this particular.
Yes. Right? And it may change tomorrow and you still must subscribe to it. Mm-hmm. You cannot, you know.
Don't ask questions. No. You won't get any warning, but perfect compliance is expected.
And what's interesting there is one of the reasons I think that humanity always goes back towards that model, especially in the last couple of hundred years, is that they don't believe in spontaneous order, which is like, if you look at the best economic systems, they're always related to individualism, which is like free market economics and things like that, which means that because of the nature of humans, because we're not bees, because we're not schools of fish, because we're not birds. Because we have reason.
Right.
We will, by spontaneous order, in a decentralized fashion, work with the people around us until we have all of these things happen. And then eventually, everybody will kind of get closer to a better living situation as time goes on. And the more that somebody tries to have their hands on the control, which is the central authority, authoritarian model, then the more you're going to suffer. Like, you'll have these unintended consequences. Mm-hmm. So for example, like the vaccine mandate at restaurants where you have to show your documentation before you dine. Mm-hmm. Well, I went into a restaurant, which was for takeout. And what I saw there is that you actually have all of these, this whole lineup of takeout. So what ends up happening is that the spontaneous order of the people will overcome any of that authoritarian edict. So you have all of these people lined up for their takeout and nobody's eating in the restaurant because they don't partake in that system, which was directed to them because it doesn't actually work practically. So what you have instead is a bunch of people sitting at tables in the restaurant waiting for their takeout. So you have the complete opposite of what the edict is coming down from on top.
Trying to create.
Right.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And, you know, as you're speaking, I'm also thinking about, we have this, I think, tendency to believe that there is no alternative to living with government. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we kind of think that we're just born into a state and that government is inevitable. I think we also think that it's inherently good for some strange reason. I'm not, but that's a bit of a different issue. But we think that, you know, I mentioned Aristotle before. He said that man is a political animal. There is a sense in which we do seek, I think, community and companionship with other people, and that we want to organize ourselves in certain ways. But it's not inevitable that we have a monarchical system. It's not inevitable that we have a republic. It's not inevitable that we form a constitution. I mean, these are not inevitable for human beings. And I'm reminded as we're talking about, Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, who wrote in their political philosophies about what it is that motivated us as humans to get out of the state of nature. And it was not to form grand, elaborate governmental structures where every aspect of our lives is mediated by our public officers. It was not to do that. It was very minimal, right? It was not, let's get out of the state of nature so that we can have perfectly structured and better lives. It was just, I would like to submit to the sovereign so that I can have some minimal protections, right? In the state of nature, people can come along and steal my cow or take my wife or kill me or something. And that's nasty, brutish, and short, you know, as Hobbes described. And so we don't really want to live like that, maybe. So we'll agree to trade off our absolute freedom in order to get, we'll give up a little bit, right, in order in exchange to get some protection. But that's a very far cry from thinking that the government should have complete micromanaging control over every aspect of your life. And my view now is that what we're seeing is a complete failure of our governmental system because it has overstepped the initial implicit contract that we as humans made to form government in the first place. And it's no longer serving us, right? And we I think, have, in virtue of the government breaking the contract, we also, therefore, have reason to get out of this contract. You know, what that would look like moving forward, I don't know, but it's almost more of a conceptual exercise than a practical one, right? We don't actually have to dissolve parliament now, but I do think we need to realize that its value is not pure and perfect and inevitable.
Wow, that's a lot to think about. but that's a great, great place to start, because I think that, you know, because we were born into government, you know, and the last few generations were, these have just been part of our traditions as well, the modern
night. And it's been fairly good for the most part. So we haven't had much reason to question it, maybe.
Right, yeah. In a sense. But it's just been encroaching more and more, you know, especially over the last 100 years. Mm-hmm. And so I think it's also really attached to the monetary systems and no longer having a gold standard attached to our money, which just allows the government excess purse strings that they can just print, and then I think that this also is part of the whole situation now, right? Where people are kind of bound in servitude to the government as well, because there's also this money, the value of money itself is attached to the government, so the government can just increase and grow and grow and grow, bloated, fat, and gorge itself, overspend, but then, you know.
I think, and you tell me if I'm wrong about this, but my feeling is that Most people are either unaware of our perilous economic situation or feel as though it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking back to some classroom conversations with students and how many of them said, well, why does it matter if Canada is in massive debt? Why does that matter? Won't we just get bailed out? Can't we just borrow more? We seem to be doing fine.
How many billions of the money tree? And because it's also seen as a notion removed from the individual. It's the collective notion, again, of this is our monetary system for all. It has nothing to do with me as an individual. There'll
always be a check coming.
Yes. But when you can't buy anything with that check anymore, like you look at Venezuela and other countries that have collapsed, you know, their financial systems have collapsed. Well, that's where you see. There's also, when we were driving up here yesterday, we stopped for takeout and, you know, we had a burger at Burger King and ordered like a mini Whopper Jr., right? But it was actually like a Whopper mini. It was like the size of the sandwich has changed, but certainly the price has increased.
Yeah.
And so that's how does it affect me? Well, you know, your $100 bill will no longer be able to buy you the same amount of things that it did last year. And that will increase and increase and increase. And then our living norms, our living standards will change over time, mm-hmm. right? Where we'll actually be increasingly poor, you know, even though we might have the same amount of money or more in our bank account, we won't be able to mm-hmm. live the same ways that prior generations did.
We've been able to, I think, compensate for that so far, maybe by the incredible credit system. I mean, the borrowing you can't go to a bank machine without it offering you free money these mm-hmm. days, right? Mm-hmm. Sign up for this and get $1,000 transferred here extend your line of credit, borrow against something else, you know. And I know TD, for example, their advertising campaign is particularly focused on this, you know, how to create money out of nothing, basically. And it's quite possible. It's amazing how much credit is able to be obtained. And when you have that, you can participate economically as a citizen, and you can feel as though you have wealth and value as a participating member of society, and that you're contributing to, keeping the economic wheels turning, and mm-hmm. and you have this facade of a very comprehensive, well-off, luxury even life. But all of that is dependent on a number of things that are beyond our control, right? It's dependent on that credit system continuing. It's dependent on a certain kind of interest rates. It's dependent on you keeping your job. It's dependent on things like how expensive cauliflower is at the grocery store.
Right.
And I think that if people are really thinking seriously, they will realize that the actual rate of inflation is not what's reported by our federal government.
Right. It's what we actually see.
Yes. And what we're seeing is, I think people who, you know, were used to spending $150 a week at the grocery store for a family a few years ago are finding that they're not able to do that anymore.
Yeah, it's no longer the case. Mm-hmm. And so again, it kind of comes to, in a way, your actions and your words matching, right? So mm-hmm. what do things actually appear? How do they appear on the surface, on the superficial level? Mm-hmm. And how are they actually experienced? And mm-hmm. all this means that, you know, if you're talking about younger people who are moving into the future thinking that this is all okay, mm-hmm. well, it means that they have a ball and chain attached to ever-growing government. And ever-growing government just means that they have the authority to say, well, we're going to make a condition of your employment a vaccination and a booster and all of these kinds of
and
things.
And who knows
and
what else?
What will that become?
What other kind of pharmaceutical enhancements? What other kind of tracking? You know, and as you're talking about young people, I'm thinking as someone who's taught university very recently, and so 18 to 20, young 20-something, generally speaking, I was haunted every day by how unhappy my students were. Maybe that was just me making them unhappy. But, you know, walking around campus, this is not a happy, flourishing group of people who are supposed to be having the time of their lives and explore, you know, and exploring all of the different paths for knowledge and laying the foundations of their future and developing relationships. this is a miserable group of people, I think, and a terrorized group of people. I remember speaking with someone months ago, and I think she had just spoken to a university student who said that basically no one under 40 thinks that anything good can ever happen again.
Wow.
You know, and that's consistent with the mental children and adolescents. The health crisis that was declared in the UK months ago. It's consistent with the, I think McMaster just reported a 300% increase in emergency visits related to suicidal behavior.
For children
The American
and adolescents.
Pediatric Society just declared a mental health crisis for youth. So, I mean, whatever we're doing, and whether you want to blame it on the pandemic, I don't think, you know, I mean, we were laying the foundations for this years before that. I think we have an incredibly unhappy, fear-based, terrorized, hamstrung, aimless group of young people. And that is, I mean, we were talking about utilitarianism quite a bit today. That is not the goal of the utilitarian. So either utilitarianism is a wrong-headed moral theory, or those who have been trying to achieve utilitarian ends are not doing a very good job of it.
Well, this is interesting because one of the, one of the principles of utilitarianism is hedonism. Mm-hmm. Which is basically searching for the most pleasure and the least amount of pain, which is quite interesting because what you're describing here is people who are in immense amounts of pain. So following that utilitarian style program, which is kind of, I think, utilitarianism, collectivism, they go hand in hand. I mean, that's how they need to function. You know, collectivist ideology only functions with utilitarian kind of dogmas. And so you have this, you know, search for pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. And the more that you're searching for it, the more that you find pain. And that's, you know, through the empty TikTok videos and through the 15-second short videos that say nothing at all. And, you know, things of little substance, right? And then you're seeing it's sad and it's true that how can the future generation look forward and say, you know, what is there for us? So of course, what are they going to do? They're going to escape. They're going to find other means of trying to pursue that hedonistic end.
In ways they can control, right? So if you can't create pleasure in the real world, but you can create it in the world of social media or in a gaming world, or in a drug-induced world.
Right.
Why wouldn't you, right? And I think one thing we know from history, I mean, hedonism is not a new theory, right? I mean, there were schools of hedonism in the ancient world. And I think the one thing we've learned from them is if you want to experience pleasure, the surefire way not to get it is to pursue it directly.
Right.
And back to Aristotle again, you know, he said there's a difference between living your life as though you're moving from one pleasure to the next. There's a difference between being a hedonist and trying to experience pleasure all the time and directing your life towards something more fruitful, trying to become virtuous in his mind, then coming to understand what virtue really gives you and how it creates integrity and wholeness of character in your life, then pleasure will supervene on that state. So ironically and very interestingly, I think he's right about that. I think human nature is such that if we truly want to experience pleasure, we can't go after it.
Yes.
We have to find something else that is more inherently worthy, and then the pleasure will come.
Wow. That makes so much sense.
And we've lost that or never knew it or something. And it's a shame because we have so many people now, I think, working so hard to find that kind of pleasure and happiness and wholeness in life, and just working from the wrong recipe.
So I think that this is why we're also seeing that young age category, the 18-year-olds or so, you know, the new coming generation, one of the reasons why they're also so conformist and they've just said okay to all of this is because of that lack of meaning and that lack of foresight that there will be anything that will be rewarding for them in the long term. They're just kind of on the hamster wheel, right? And so what I'm trying to think here is always like, what are the solutions to the current problems? And I think that maybe a potential solution for people of that age category is to have some kind of access to the individualistic model, because we've been swinging so much more towards the collectivist model, and this is where we're at now. Maybe if they could kind of come back to, you know, Stoic philosophy, moving towards individualism, and what it means. How do we achieve it?
I don't know. And it's interesting because you mentioned the Stoics, and the Stoics were a group of philosophers who were very, there's a lot in common with Eastern religions and philosophies and Stoicism. And it's a little bit like, it's the philosophy sort of come what may, I have this sort of stability of character that can withstand it all. And there's it tends to be coupled with that, a relinquishing of attachment to material things, because we realize that they can come and go, they're beyond our control. And all we can really control is our own internal lives. Right. So it's possible that a lot of this is connected to our heavy consumerism and materialistic society that we place so much value. It's very dangerous, right, to place so much value and to place one's ultimate worth in what you in what you own and things that are beyond you, outside of yourself, because those things can be taken away very easily.
We've seen that.
And if your whole, your character, if your quality of life, if your sense of self-esteem, if what matters to you, if what makes a good day for you or a good life for you depends solely on the physical stuff that you can buy or steal or get somehow, and you can't do that anymore, you've lost everything. So it's not really, materialism is not really a very rational position, because it too greatly rests on things beyond your control. And I do think I'm not sort of advocating for a complete asceticism or a complete abandoning of a system of commerce. I'm not advocating for that. But I think if we did realize that there's a richness to be found in the internal mental life and introspection and activities that cost no money, there's richness to be found in good conversation, which isn't just gossip, and it's not just the exchange of items of sort of derogatory comments to other people, but genuine, deep, exposing conversation and building relationships on those things. No one can take that away from you. The government can't. The person with whom you have a relationship could die even, but you would still have the memory of the richness of that life. And I think we need to, you know, realize that our lives are better the more self-sufficient we're able to be, and the more we can rely on things that are within our control.
Oh, that is beautiful. I think it's very profound. I'm also thinking about how capitalism is connected to true capitalism, not what we have now. What we have now is not capitalism. But true capitalism, which has such a bad name, is really about free market exchange, which is about all of those invisible systems of people basically just trading
What they have, not what they've been able to borrow, right? Legitimately have.
That's right. And doing this in a way with whoever. It doesn't matter of your ethnicity, your background, your medical status, as long as you have something that I want and I have something that you want, well, we can exchange
voluntarily with consent.
Right. And it actually makes the outcomes far more equal than any kind of program that you could design. Right. So what's interesting, though, is that it often, because of its connection with individualism, right, the fact that we also have this bad rap given to consumerism, which is different, right? Because of exactly what you're saying, because there's a lack of connection with the self because people have started to look outwards for meaning in their life. Mm-hmm. It seems that they're mixed together and everything is just, well, our whole system doesn't work. So individualism doesn't work. Capitalism doesn't work. All of those things, selfishness, they're all thrown into the same category, right? So kind of like all of those, the moral, the economic, the philosophical, they're all rejected as a whole. And then you find yourself in the kind of system that we're in. Hmm. But so we're seeing the result of that is misery.
And I think you're right. I think people, you know, individually and collectively, we are in a state of misery. And I think what you describe as kind of throwing everything out, it's kind of this postmodern throwing everything out, has left us in with a kind of nihilism and emptiness with nothing to grab hold of. And one thing that's very interesting, my understanding is that, you know, in the psychological literature, we understand that people's happiness depends a lot on having meaning and focus and commitment and purpose and things like that. And so it's interesting that often people who are religious in some way have a higher reported level of happiness because they believe in something. Mm-hmm. And what's important there is usually not what it is they believe in or whether or not what they believe in is true, but that they have something to orient their lives around. And I think we've lost that in society, right? We're not just a secular society, we're an empty society.
Wow.
Right? I think for most people, and you know, in casual conversations with people who are willing to be vulnerable and open about this, you usually get to this point. You know, that people will say, I get up. I don't really know what to do with my days. I have everything.
Netflix and chill.
Netflix and chill. And there are actually a lot of memes right now to this effect. You know, there'll be something like, I intended to get up and exercise and vacuum and write all day. But in reality, I ended up just eating ice cream and watching Netflix. And I think it's partly because we feel like our actions are ultimately pointless anyway.
Right.
And there's no reason to develop our lives, to develop our character, because we're not aware of what the payoff of that work might be. Maybe we're not seeing it in other people's lives. Maybe we don't feel as though it's socially valuable. I'm not sure, but I do think that that misery you described is either coupled with or the result of this emptiness and aimlessness and lack of purpose.
And this is where you have these ready-made ideologies that, such as the whole COVID from A to Z, everything up until now, has been this ready-made system, this collectivist system that you can now outsource your meaning to.
And your thinking. And your responsibility.
Yes. Yes. So your the meaning that you've been looking for. Now you can feel like there are, you know, in that social posturing, you know, like what you're describing, like going into a store, sanitizing your hands, looking around you, all of those things, you know, are hedonistic. They're leading you to this feeling of pleasure in the moment because you're looking around you. You get a nod from the next person.
Good for and me. They're, I'm part of the group.
Yes, they're in it with you. And so it actually, you have these little micro pleasures throughout the day
and taking part in that system. And quite a good endorphin pump out of that activity.
There you go. Right.
And why we're, and you know, we know neurophysiologically how we become addicted to these things. You know, it's like runners talk about their runner's high. Yes. Well, I think that this virtue signaling and being part of society in that way is a bit of a metaphor. I mean, it would have the similar kind of effect in the brain, right? You do something that you perceive to be a value and solidify your position in the social group. Mm-hmm. In some sense, it's a lot easier than running. Why wouldn't you do that?
So you don't actually have to do anything, right? Yeah. Like you can actually just go and, you know, so you can have a day where you've done really nothing. You can just sit at home and you can even exchange now. And have you seen the metaverse? This new, oh my gosh. So this is Mark Zuckerberg of Facebook.
Oh, yes, yes. I know what you mean. Right.
So, right. It's an extension of like the gaming world gone awry even, and all of those things. Yeah. So now you don't even have to leave your home and go to the grocery store and give a thumbs up to somebody anymore. Like you can actually
you can electronically virtue signal now.
Right.
So you don't even have to.
And in some sense, and it's interesting because I think you're talking about how little work that is. Also, you're going to bank those activities such that you don't have to do them as much. There'll probably be a dwindling number of them you have to do on a daily basis because you've already solidified your social position.
Right.
So if you've done enough virtue signaling for the first, say, 3 months of the pandemic, and everybody knows you to be the kind of person who does those kinds of things, you've bought your membership. It's like a lifetime membership in this tribe. You don't really need to work for it anymore.
Right. It's done. You're in. You know? I want to ask you as well, what was your experience with teaching? Because I've noticed too with, you know, with music students that they don't want to learn like how to play piano properly. They're just kind of like, this is hard. This is hard. And it's actually really not hard at all sometimes what I'm describing. Like it's just different. It's just new. And they just say, oh, this is hard. I don't want to do this. Like, can we do something else? You know? And it's really interesting to kind of see that because it's a really different way than previous models and previous generations where you would say, well, you know, if you work hard, there is a reward to that. You know, you feel
but it's an inherent reward.
Yes.
Right? It's I see exactly that. You know, in university classes, there's very little indication, unfortunately, that young people are interested in learning for its own sake. And I mean, I've had so many conversations with young people who are worried about losing their place in university if they don't provide proof of vaccination. And they're desperate to hold on to their place in university. But when you have a conversation with them about why that is, it's not because they want to continue their learning. It's because they want to get their degree. So it's all of this end state focus on, you know, the process is important, but it's back to the collectivism, consequentialism again, right? The process is important only insofar as it produces a certain result. Right. And if you could attain that result through another means that's maybe less involved or less expensive or less arduous, then they clearly would.
Right.
We don't see, I mean, even when I was in undergrad or grad school, there were groups of students who would get together outside of the classroom to talk about things. And that had nothing to do with the, you know, getting you your degree any faster or in better ways or something, but they just did it for out of interest.
Right.
I haven't seen that as much, surely. Right. And I think that, you know, to tie this back to our conversation about emptiness, focusing on results to the exclusion of process is very closely connected to, being end-oriented or goal-oriented in that way, that eliminates the value of the process, leaves one disconnected from the process. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's very hard to derive any kind of value that's connected to that project, right? So now, I mean, if you are at university only to get a degree, what it will mean to you is what that degree can get you.
Right.
It gets you a better job. Well, why do you want that? Because it can get me the right house, the right social position, the right vehicle. But now there's no, I mean, you think about people who do want to learn for its own sake, that value is immeasurable. The satisfaction that comes from that is immeasurable. It's incommensurate with, you know, a large black SUV that's sitting in your driveway.
Yeah. I think you've tapped into something there. I'm just thinking about this a little bit. So if you looked at, let's say, the baby boomers generation, right, and the one before them, mm-hmm. and then ours trickling out of that, mm-hmm. there have still been those lingering elements of, well, you get educated or you go to a trade school so mm-hmm. that then you can have this long-term career, so that then you can buy the house, you have the mortgage, and you can afford all of this. Like, it was times of abundance and relative stability, right? So you could actually provide for your family and you could find meaning in that, right? You could actually find happiness mm-hmm. As some of the outcomes to this this path that you're on. And then you could learn along the way, and there was meaning in that as well. But now what we're seeing with postmodernism, and this is largely, I believe, a result of the progressive values taking over, is that getting married and having children is not important. And this started even in our generation. Women, girl power. You don't need a man in your life. You know, feminism, that whole thing, right? And then, you know, just wait to have children. Don't have children at all. Children are bad for the environment also. You know, they're little carbon emitters over there. You don't need that, you know? And, well, then you don't need to do any of that at all. And then who are you? Well, are you even a woman? Are you a man? I mean, how do you feel? What do you think? All of our identities are getting confused as well, right? Mm-hmm. And so then what do you do? And you keep going along this path, and it's a really empty path. And then the end of that path is nothing. It's spiritual suicide, if not suicide itself. Mm-hmm. And so then you think, how did this generation get there? Well, this is how. If you tell them all, there's no such thing as anything. Moral relativism. There's no right. There's no wrong. There's no he. There's no she.
Then anything you do is equally as good as anything else.
Exactly.
In some sense, although it's very odd to me that we have coupled with this complete postmodern nihilism, anything goes, is also a very rigid objective adherence to this tribal mentality. Don't you dare veer from what's expected.
It's not consistent.
It's not consistent. So it's very within the so this postmodern view where there are fluid categories to everything is very non-binary. It's not black and white, mm-hmm. right? The kind of tribalism and collectivism we're talking about, it's binary, but it's hardly binary anymore because it's not like it even recognizes
maybe
that there's a result.
Maybe it's part of the reaction to the postmodernist kind of movement, right? Like it's you need to have that equal and opposite result. Maybe. So if you're trying to detach from all meaning and all sense of black and white and gray, even, mm-hmm. you know, well, then you're going to end up with these systems that are completely tribal, that are completely rigid, mm-hmm. that are completely contrary mm-hmm. to this ideology.
You may be right that it's cyclical, that human nature is such that we move in and out of cycles of objectivism and subjectivism, and that when we're in the sort of the relativist, a part of that cycle, we start out and it feels like it's a state of freedom, but that freedom very quickly becomes a kind of emptiness and misery. We don't want to live there forever. Mm-hmm. We latch onto something, but we've been out of the system of objectivism for so long that we don't really have the tools to figure out what truth is anymore. So we latch on to the first thing that kind of looks like it. And that's maybe a bit of a mirage. Yeah. And that might be where we're at now, you know, and that we're so desperate subconsciously maybe to move out of this state of nihilism and misery that our desperation is getting us to latch on to anything that offers itself as a kind of beacon of stabilization and hope.
I think you pinned the nail on the donkey. And I think that this
I'm not crazy about the donkey, but
no. And I think that this is the COVID donkey. I think that that's exactly what that is, because none of it makes any sense. None of it, at all. Yeah. But,
and yet it's highly compelling.
It is. It's something to attach yourself to.
Something.
Anything.
The litmus test, I think, comes when we follow to its natural conclusion what attaching ourselves to this particular narrative and this particular, I think, a kind of blind allegiance to a very weird conception of science, where that gets us and what it will take to make us realize that we've pinned the tail on the wrong donkey, to be honest.
So how do you think that we get out of this? Like, I mean, I think not one person can answer the question, but or where do you see things going?
Yeah, you know, I've just finished writing a book and was trying very hard to think about this for the last chapter or two, and to think about what can we offer in terms of hope as a kind of escape hatch out of this, you know? And I think there are multiple components to that. But one thing I say in the book is I think we do need to embrace a kind of individualism again, if only so as to give ourselves some space to make a conscious decision about whether or not we want to be collectivists. So I think we need to kind of step back from the madding crowd, stop listening to the constant barrage of data and messaging that's coming from that crowd, just get some peace and quiet and see what we think about things and reflect in our own space using our own reason. And decide whether or not what we're doing is serving us, whether or not it's making sense, whether or not people are happy, whether they have hope, whether they're fulfilled. And then I think if we have that kind of peace and solitude and get a sense of who we are for some time, I don't know how long, it's probably different for different people, right? Mm-hmm. Depending on how much they've lost over mm-hmm. the last months, years, decades, you know. But once we have a better, firmer sense of who we are as individuals, then I think we can start to approach other people again and engage in conversation with them, but always being aware or trying to be more aware of when things are not looking quite right. And I think we've lost that kind of moral compass now. We've lost that ability to reflect. Reflection requires a distance, right? It requires saying, okay, I hear what you're saying, but give me a minute. I have to step back and think about whether or not that's true, doing my own project, my own work as an individual, and I'll come back and let you know, right? It requires that distance from the group, I think. Whether or not a group can be self-reflective, well, that's an interesting question. My inclination is to think that it can't be. But I think that's an interesting question nonetheless, you know. And I was reading, interestingly, a lot of Walt Whitman when I was writing these chapters. And he was confronting the same sort of issue with his view of the American public many, many years ago, though it's very, very timely now. And his feeling is that we've lost literature. It's interesting. You know, he writes, I forget where, but he writes about how the great civilizations, when all is lost, when their buildings crumble, when their governments fall apart, what's left are their ideas. And those ideas are communicated through art and literature and poetry. And we don't really pay attention to art, literature, and poetry anymore. We think these things are frivolous or empty, or maybe they require too much work. I don't know. Right. You know, but I think his view is that when we lose those things, we lose a connection to the past and we lose an understanding of what makes life worth living. Yeah. So as sort of, you know, silly as it might sound with all that's going on around us right now, I think we really do need to embrace the devices in society that allow us to be connected with the past, to understand history. We need to read more and read the right kinds of things, you know?
That's wonderful. I think that's very, it comes full circle. Mm-hmm. And it made me think as well, as you were speaking of Charles Mackay, you know, men lose their minds in crowds, but they come back to their senses one by one. And if you're reading, you know, that is your space as well to be an individual, completely unique, to think for yourself, to create your own universe based on these stories and these words.
It's not a lonely place necessarily. You can have friendship and companionship in that universe, right? But you don't need to be defined by the opinions of other people.
Right. Well, I suggest on this note that everybody reads your book. I'm looking forward to reading it. And I think that there is something to be said there. I believe that, you know, there is a cycle happening here and we'll continue to watch it unfold. I have faith for the future, for our children. And I think that you've done some incredible work here as an individual. And I highly encourage people to follow what you do. I'm very inspired from our talk. So thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for watching this film. If you value our work, please visit very-opinionated.com to help support our productions.
Good to go.
Yeah, I know these things are often, I agree, kind of emotional because it's, I think we, you know, in talking, you just realize, you realize how big the problem is because you start realizing how long it's taken to get here, you know, and how much it frames. I mean, there are people that are, we're talking about 18, 20 year olds have never lived a life outside of this context, you know.
I know, and our babies, right? Like their whole lives so far.
Yeah. Yes, well, this pandemic context, but I mean, you know, university students have never lived outside of this collectivism that's been getting steam, this postmodernism. They don't know.
Though they might hear,
and they might think, yeah, I do feel kind of miserable.
Well, you're speaking.